Welcome to Tactical Tennis, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Jacob Meyer.
And I'm Glenn Hill. And today we're going to talk about coaching high-level players, what that relationship looks like, and the types of high-level, quote-unquote high-level coaches that are out there, and how players should match themselves up with the right type of coach for what they need.
I like how you did that lead-in, because realistically, we decided to do this today instead of later on because of something that happened over the weekend, right?
And by something, we mean Novak Djokovic just firing his entire actual coaching staff.
Yeah. Well, wait. Did he fire his entire actual coaching staff? This is one of the first questions. There's one guy whose name hasn't been mentioned.
Yeah, so if we read the actual press release comment from Novak, it says, "I'm forever grateful to Marianne Gigi, who's his fitness trainer, Emilian, his physio, for a decade of friendship, professionalism, and commitment to my career goals." And of course, the big name that's missing from there is, drumroll please, Jacob,
Pepe Imaz.
Exactly. Who can we call him a coach?
Who's Pepe Imaz?
Pepe Imaz.
I don't really know.
right. So obviously, you know, I know, and some of the people listening may know, and some of the people may not, but this really, I think looking at the phenomenon of Pepe Imaz and his relationship with Novak Djokovic highlights so many important things about not just the impact that a quote-unquote coach or advisor or guide can have on a tennis player, but also the importance for a high-level player of managing everything surrounding their game in such a way as to allow them to continue to perform at a high level over extended periods of time. Something that we have touched on previously. And I think now looking at this train wreck of a year for Novak, it's important to revisit that idea in this context. So who is Pepe Imaz?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, he was a Spanish tennis player. So I was excited to learn that he actually was a tennis player, because at first everything I heard about him indicated that he wasn't. Apparently he runs some sort of academy, which I say that way because academy can be like Sanchez Casal or IMG, or it can be just a guy with a tennis court, right? So I've got no idea what the size and scope of that stuff is, but it seems like he fundamentally bases his coaching, I don't even know what to call it. He bases his coaching style in a philosophy of love and peace and the power of extended, like, 60-second hugs, like embraces.
To put a little background on this, Pepe, what was his real name again? You looked that up, because he goes by Pepe Imaz now, but
Jose Imaz Ruiz.
Was actually a professional player. He won two challenger doubles titles. Took Carlos Moya to, what, a 20-point tiebreaker in a singles match once?
30 points.
30-point tiebreaker.
Just so, like 16-14.
So let's put that in some context. So I think he topped out career-wise with a ranking in the 160s. But look, if you take Carlos Moya at virtually any point in his career to a 30-point tiebreaker, you know how to play tennis pretty damn well.
Yeah.
No, there's no way around that. So the guy was a good tennis player. He was a very good tennis player. Obviously not good enough to become a household name, but the depth of men's tennis, that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
There were 20 Spaniards in the top 200 back then, so...
Yes, being the, you know, 19th best Spaniard was still meant you were pretty dang good. But point being, this guy was still, you know, a very, very good player, a very high-level player. He knows what's up when it comes to tennis, or at least he did once upon a time. So this isn't some random Joe off the street. It's not like Novak Djokovic hiked up into the mountains of the Himalayas and found some spiritual guru and said, hey, come back and help guide my life and tennis career. This was a guy who has some bona fide credentials when it comes to tennis. And I think it is important to note as well that a lot of people listening probably hear, oh, this guy was only 160 in the world. You know, whoopity-doo, big deal. How much can you really know? And some of that maybe is a bit of a reaction to, we've had this slew of quote-unquote celebrity coaches lately with Boris Becker and Stefan Edberg. You know, a lot of these former world number ones and big names taking the reins with high-level players. But there are coaches out there on the pro tour whose name you either do know or should know, who had similar caliber careers in professional tennis as players, who are legitimate world-class coaches.
Yeah, or even worse. I mean, in some sense, a lot of the guys I think that get to that level, it's maybe 50-50, but they understand some things about what work that the top guys don't. I mean, Djokovic was 160 when he was like 18 years old. It just came naturally to him. And when you spend your career in the 160s, you spend a lot of time searching for answers and working really hard on process and doing things that can be really helpful for any player, whether you're number one in the world and trying to chase down the greatest player of all time, like Novak Djokovic, or whether you're a guy 300 in the world that's just trying to get into the top 100.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that's interesting to me is that Imaz, who catches a lot of slack online and just generally, and frankly, even around the tour, I mean, people just refer to him as Novak's guru. Nobody even uses his name. Nobody has anything bad to say about him. They just associate some seemingly mental changes in Novak's approach to tennis with Imaz.
I would imagine probably there's some negative things being said behind closed doors. But well, Novak being who he is, I would also imagine that a lot of people are avoiding saying some things negative. And just for one moment, I want to pause here for a second and just retouch on this idea of how good of a player you need to be in order to be a high-level coach. There's a certain coach out there now who peaked out his singles ranking at 826 in the world and coached the following players: Monica Seles, Arantxa Sanchez Vicario, Mary Pierce, Anna Ivanovic, Wozniacki, Michael Stich, Greg Rusedski, Tommy Haas, Maria Sharapova, Mario Ancic. I'm talking, of course, about Sven Groeneveld.
We got your point.
Right.
And most of those players won a slam when he worked with them, so it wasn't like he just hung around them.
No, absolutely. These are players who won slams with him. Not all of them won slams with him, but certainly multiple of them won slams with him. Look, enough people either made number one under him, stayed number one, or won slams with him, that we obviously know that Sven knows what's up when it comes to coaching. The guy's one of the best coaches out there, but obviously his singles career was not particularly stellar. And that's important because this isn't really a podcast about Pepe Imaz. This is a podcast about coaching high-level players and what that can look like and what that takes. And so Sven would be an example of somebody who knows how to coach, and he's certainly a significantly higher caliber coach than he was a caliber player. So when we bring this conversation back to Imaz, just saying
that goes
look,
for us as well.
Yes. Yeah, thank God, right? Look, when it comes to Imaz, obviously the fact that he only topped out in the 100s doesn't automatically mean he doesn't know what's up. That's not why he's not a good fit for Novak, right? I just really want to hammer that point home, because when we start to talk about some of these other coaches and pairings and who Novak might look at next to work with him, that becomes an important framework for that conversation.
In some sense, I would almost prefer that he wasn't as good of a player. It just makes sense that he was able to, that he found himself sort of as part of this team. I don't want to say that he worked his way in there, because I don't know that that's what he did. But he was working with Novak's little brother. His little brother said that he was suffering from depression and that this guy used his methods, basically. I mean, the reports say that he cured that. I don't know how Marco's talking about it.
Right. I mean, we're probably pretty safe to say that if Marco genuinely had clinical depression, he wasn't cured by a long hug from Pepe. So what else happened, we don't know. But the important thing is that essentially he found himself having influence over Novak.
And it seems like, I mean, to be fair, it seems like Marco did at least find some peace. He got to a place where he felt better about lots of things. I mean, if you follow Marco, his tennis hasn't exactly gone through the roof. So it begs the question that this coach that preaches love and peace would make the jump from Marco, who was in what, like the 300s, 400s,
mm-hmm.
600s for a while. I'm not sure where he is right now, but would make that jump from him to Novak, who's obviously, you know, was top two, and I mean, it sure sounds like Novak felt like he was suffering from some sort of depression.
Certainly, I think Novak felt like he needed to change something emotionally in his setup. He's gotten to the point where obviously his influence over Novak is so strong and his bond with Novak is so strong that Novak literally just fired the guy who had been his mentor and father figure from when he was 19 years old, but kept Pepe on board. So there's something significant.
We think he's kept Pepe on board because he hasn't said that he's fired him.
Yes, and certainly.
And how do you fire a guy who just teaches love and peace all the time?
Right. Well, I guess that's a good question. But I think it's of note that when Novak was in his little fender bender the other day, like the car that he was driving had, you know, Pepe's love and peace logo on there. So let's not get too hung up on Pepe and Novak. Part of this whole conversation was sparked because, the whole conversation was sparked because Novak fired his team. And that, of course, raises this very glaring, obvious question, which is who is going to coach Novak Djokovic now? And, of course, that's assuming that he's actually going to hire a real coach and not hug his way back to number one, or try to hug his way. I think he's hugging his way back to number one, but certainly trying to hug his way back to number one. Assuming he is going to try and find a real coach, that leads us to this idea of, well, what does that look like? Because we've seen players over the last 3 or 4 years make some very high-profile hirings in terms of their coaching staff. We've also seen some players make some lower-profile hirings and have very good results. So there's obviously different routes. And so this brings us to this whole conversation of what does that relationship at the high level, we're talking college, high-level college players and beyond, really look like? Because it's going to change from player to player and coach to coach. And what should people look for when they're trying to find the right fit?
Well, that's a good question.
Thank you.
Ironically, I think one of the first places that you actually look is what's between the ears and where are you mentally now and where are you trying to be, and finding someone who matches up with that, which I think to some degree Novak's trying to do with the whole Pepe thing. But I think there's a bigger question, or at least a more pressing question at the moment for him of, what are his goals? Like, if his goals are obviously not to stay top 30 in the world, he can hire anyone and stay top 30. So, if you're, say, a college player that's just graduated over the last couple of years and you're making your way on your tour and you're trying to get to top 100, then that's a different thing than if you're trying to, say, recapture some tennis that you've played in the past, or if you're trying to push yourself to develop new skills.
Right. And that's I think, an important point, because every player has a different need. And when we look at what happens at the high level, we're talking about players who have very well-developed skill sets. At this point, they have typically weapons. They also probably have some level of weaknesses. And they also will have a fairly decent understanding of their game and how they win points. It may not be that explicit. Some of it may be intuitive. But these are not people that are still really trying to figure everything out. They've got a lot of, and sometimes that's a bad thing, in that they're very well ingrained. They've done a lot of whatever it is that they do. And one of the things that we do notice with high-level players is that they tend to be very resistant to change, or that when change happens, it tends to happen very slowly.
And they also,
go ahead.
I just want to jump in on that, because when you talk about, especially when you talk about top 100 players, they oversimplify things. So you take someone like Gael Monfils, and his view is basically, and this is the view that probably 90 out of the top 100 guys have of Gael, He just needs someone to motivate him. He can do whatever he feels like. He's got more than enough tennis to be like a top 5 player. He just needs to work harder and really be motivated each time when he steps out on the court.
So really quickly, are we talking about Gael Monfils or Kyrgios?
No, I'm actually talking about Gael.
No, I know. It's the parallels are obvious.
The one thing that I think is a little bit different between them is I think that Kyrgios actually intuitively is much better at committing to patterns and executing patterns that really are good for his game. Yes. I mean, Molfi goes out there and hits the ball up the middle of the court and just says, I'm going to win with my athleticism.
Sure.
And then he doesn't, like, he's not the fittest guy on the tour. So
no, absolutely. I'm with you on that front. Just more drawing the parallels with the motivation and the role
there's
that
lots,
a coach would play in the motivation.
There's lots of that. And this is the idea, right? I mean, like, Kyrgios just turned, 23 years old a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So he's a young guy. Molfi now is 30, and you can look at Nick as, you know, a younger version of that type of player. But if all you think that you need is just motivation, I mean, you're missing the boat. Motivation doesn't just come on its own.
No, and motivation is a very fleeting thing in all reality.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of these big things that I spend a lot of time talking about with younger athletes is you cannot rely on motivation to get you across the finish line. You can't rely on motivation to help you train because motivation will come and motivation will go. And if your training and commitment matches your motivation level, then your training is going to be very inconsistent and up and down. And it really comes down to that discipline of doing the work even when you don't feel like it.
And that's something that Molfi struggled with for a long time. I mean, now at 30 years old, he seems to be working harder than ever. But anyway, so the point being, players oversimplify this stuff. And there's a culture on the tour where they reinforce each other. And so they actually think that they're right. They really think, well, this is like the only thing that I need. And so a lot of people talking about Novak are just talking about how to get him back to where he was. Mm-hmm. And they're really, to me, seem to be missing the fact that, you know, Novak is a, like, he's just a guy like you or like me, wakes up in the morning, he puts his pants on one leg at a time. You know, if he wants to be fit, he has to work hard. If he wants to be lean, he has to eat well. Yeah, you know, if he wants to have energy, he has to eat more food and the right food. And, you know, you can't ignore his mental state. If he was depressed, then it needs to be addressed. Or even if he wasn't clinically depressed, if he was struggling with things, those are important and you need to deal with them just like you would deal with any other, you know, normal functioning human being that you care about.
Sure.
So in some sense, like, I can see him as being someone who laser focused in on just doing a few things really well on the tennis court and maybe didn't take care of other aspects of his life.
I mean, it's very likely that he didn't. I mean, his level of focus and commitment was extreme to the point where it's almost hard to imagine somebody who is in an emotionally healthy state actually doing all the things that he was doing in order to win.
It sounds like you're saying almost like he was obsessed.
Exactly.
With doing, like, he was obsessed with getting to that place where he could beat Roger and beat Rafa and be number one. And I don't know if it's about carving a place out in history or if it was just it might not be about anything greater than that. It might not be a big ego thing. It might have just been he's a competitor. This is the world that he's in. It just had an obsession.
I'm not for a moment trying to paint Novak as a bad guy when I say that. Just, I mean, we've all known people who have ended up in an emotional space where they might pursue something past the point where it's healthy or in a way that's not necessarily healthy for them. And I just look at the way that Novak was approaching the sport with, you know, the extremeness of his diet and his, you know, his chamber that he's sleeping in and all the things that he was doing. It almost seemed to me to go a little bit beyond of, well, I want to be the best player in the world and I'm going to do all the little things to get there to, you know, I wonder to what degree this was coming from an emotionally healthy play. You know, in the way that we've seen Roger, I think, do things in a very emotionally healthy way, in a way that's very sustainable, which is why, you know, he's still where he is now at 35 and still motivated and healthy and out there still growing and changing, right? So bringing this a little bit back to a more general idea of, you were talking a lot about these top 100 players, there's a point where there's a stubbornness to the way that they do things. Because you don't get to be a top 100 player in the world being constantly plagued by self-doubt, generally speaking, right? These guys are confident, and they know a way to do things that has gotten them a level of success that has allowed them to make a good living from playing tennis. And I think there's a lot of them operate from this place of fear, where they don't want to risk changing the things that have gotten them where they are. And then also this place of self-belief, where if I just do what I do, if I just do it a little bit better, then everything's going to be fine. I'm going to win a slam. I'm going to get to them. I'm going to do whatever it is that I'm trying to do.
That's right.
And that's really a terrible way. You know, there's this saying, if you're not getting better, then you're getting worse, because somebody out there is getting better. And so we've talked a lot about Milos Raonic and the way that he approaches practice, which is a very unique way. This is a guy who's trying to find every little edge in terms of learning and developing as a player. And he's an example of somebody who I think if he didn't have that mentality of kind of thinking outside the box and trying some things that are more cutting edge from a neuroscience perspective, he wouldn't be where he is. He wouldn't be having the career that he's having. He would be, you know, a 15 to 20 guy who goes out and bombs a big serve.
Maybe.
And smacks. Well, I think on the serve alone, he'd be there. But he'd go out there and smack some forehands every now and then. But he wouldn't virtually never break serve. I mean, it'd just be a lot of things that would hold him back.
Look, before we go too deep into Milos, drawing the distinction is really good, because we got two guys that were top five. I mean, Milos got up to three when Novak was number two. They were right next to each other not very long ago in the rankings. And they have very fundamentally different approaches. Milos's approach seems to be based on developing. He's trying to get better at everything that he does.
At the actual skill aspect of the sport. That's
the
important.
Skill, like, yeah, he's trying to get his backhand better, his forehand better, his serve better, his volleys better. He practices that stuff. And he will use science or experts or consultants to develop new ways to improve what he's doing and develop his skills. Whereas Novak was trying to use fancy sciencey stuff to just get better somehow in a really obtrusive sort of way. Like, I'm going to sleep in a hyperbaric chamber and it's going to just like make my recovery better and my athlete better. And stuff.
Right. Well, I don't think it was obtrusive. I think really what it came down to was this idea of Novak felt like his tennis game was good enough. All he needed to do was have more endurance and more fitness. I'll use the fitness term very generally, but essentially that if he could do that, if he could just be physically superior to everybody else, then he could win. And look, he in a sense, he wasn't wrong.
No, he wasn't. But listen to what you're saying.
Obviously, look at the couple years that he had.
If he could just be physically superior to everyone else, then he could be better. Like, no kidding. If you're physically superior to everyone else, you're going to be better.
Well,
look, great.
Well, I think what he's saying was, and this is important, because his game and his strategy were good enough that if he was physically superior to everybody else, he was going to be the best player out there. And I think in that regard, you know, for a time stretch, he was right. In the same way that, look, I mean, if we look at Gael Monfils, I mean, physically, what the hell? The guy is almost not human.
Right.
In some of the things that he can do, but right. His game wasn't there. Certainly his understanding of how to go about constructing points and do things in a sustainable way. Well, look, I'm going to go out there and actually margin people out and follow patterns and win. That aspect of it wasn't there. So, I mean, Monfils can get as fit and strong as he wants. It's not going to push him over the edge. Whereas for Djokovic, certainly for a time it was, but then there's this problem of if that's what you're relying on is being fitter than everybody and being just that little bit faster than everybody in what is still fundamentally a skill-based sport, you've got a problem. It's not a long-term sustainable thing, because when you're riding that fine line at the very edge of human performance and doing that over a long period, inevitably something's going to break down, and what's going to break down is either your body at some point, which, you know, we're looking at the elbow problems that he's having now, or emotionally, because the things that you have to do in order to be at that level are just, look, I mean, my brother was a sub-4-minute miler, and I used to just marvel at the things that he would put himself through on a day-to-day basis in order to run as fast as he did.
I love how you just dropped that in there. Just in case you weren't paying attention, guys, That means that the guy was an Olympic miler, okay? He's one of the fastest people on the planet. So we're not saying like, oh, he was a good college guy. Like,
no, yeah,
like you were a heck of a college player, okay?
Right. No, he was a much better runner than I was a tennis player. You know, I never obviously was going to go to the Olympics for tennis, but that was actually a real thing for him. So just watching the things that he would do and how his body was always riding on the edge of breaking down, you know, just lying around with ice packs on virtually every joint in his body was not just a daily, like it was a multiple times a day thing. Right. And this was just to maintain. This wasn't, oh, I'm going to treat these. This is just, I'm just trying to not break down.
And you're just like slowing down this terrible process.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, that's not sustainable. You can't be a sub 4 minute miler for 10 years. I mean, the body just can't do that. And when we look at where Djokovic was physically, I just don't see a way where they're even physically, if he did somehow manage to stay together, emotionally and mentally, the toll it takes to go about preparing every single day and doing all those things every single day, it just has to wear on you. There's just no way it can't wear on you. And I worry we're starting to just hyper-focus on Novak again. But bringing this back to bigger picture, this idea of what do I have to do in order to get to this next level? And unfortunately, most of the top players have this attitude of, well, my game is enough. I just need to do a little bit better version of that. I need to just do things a little bit better. Really, I think what the big problem is, a lot of the mentality comes down to, I just need to play better.
Right. Like, I just need to have a better day.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have a good day.
If I just had more good days.
It's ridiculous. Like, yeah. I can't stand it when people say that.
If I just had more good days, then I'd be fine. You know, right. I'd be number one. So,
well, I need to have my good days at the slams instead of at the 250. And right. It's like, dude, you had your good day against the bad opponent for a reason. You know,
yeah.
Or you had your big upset win against that guy who maybe is like top 25 in the world, but you seem to be neglecting the fact that he was out until 4 a.m. and he had already booked his flight and he didn't really want to be there. So anyway, I shouldn't go off on that stuff.
Yeah,
you made a really good point earlier on about the guys getting stuck in this mentality and how they're super stubborn in large part because that's part of what's gotten them there. There's also a part in which, in the psychology of each individual of the top players, they've been constantly validated for years as they get there.
Yes.
So even take someone like Nick Kyrgios, who's very young. He's still been validated over the last 3-4 years because, I mean, you can't imagine how many people as a percentage of his life come up to him and tell him that he's doing great. Like, no one wants to be the guy that goes up to him and says, you're doing a bad job.
Right. Well, and the other thing about it with
just freeze with.
Yeah. I mean, the other part of that puzzle is, especially with Nick, I mean, what are you going to do? Go up and say that to him? And you know he's going to have some burn waiting for you.
He absolutely does.
But, I mean, you'd go up and say something like that to him and the guy would say, you know, something about his ranking, be like 17, mate, or 13, mate, and just walk away. And you go, yeah, okay, I guess you are 17 in the world, fair enough. You know, there's that point where it's, yeah, what are you going to say to the guy that's actually going to get through to him and get him to understand that?
And the reason that I bring this up isn't because it's, like, it's not about Nick and it's not about Novak in this case, but there's a greater sense whether you're top 20 in the world or whether you're working with the local pro at your country club, right? Very often what players need in order to push themselves to a place of improvement is to have someone that's willing to get them out of their comfort zone.
Yes.
And when you do that, you're probably going to get some backlash, right? So to me, like, I see where Novak is. I think someone needs to get him out of his comfort zone. And that's, you know, they're going to have a spine. Because if you push a player like that out of their comfort zone, they're going to react.
Yes, and these are not
reacting at you.
These are not individuals who have a low will.
No, they have a huge drive and a huge motor inside. I mean,
yes.
Obviously, when we talk about Novak, it's easy to say, "Oh, he's got a huge motor inside." I think it's also easy for people to look at someone like Kyrgios and say, like, oh, well, he doesn't have a huge motor. But that's insane.
Yeah.
Like, that guy's motor inside is so much bigger than everyone who's listening to this. It's not even funny. Like, trust me, he has it. You're not going to be 17 in the world without it. You know, even someone that we don't think of as a great athlete, like an Ivo Karlovic, dude's like 38 years old and 21 in the world, and he's in better shape than I am. It's outrageous. Like, he works his tail off. He has to.
Yeah.
He absolutely has to. So these are people that are super dedicated, super committed to certain priorities and certain principles. And even the talented ones, I mean, they're still going to come back at you. If you're pushing them, they're going to come back at you.
For sure. So when we think about what this relationship looks like most of the time, a lot of these coaches that are out there and coaching high-level players actually have fairly narrow skill sets in terms of there's things that they do well. And it might be that the thing that they do well is strength and conditioning, or it might be the thing that they do really well is, if you look at like Brad Gilbert, for example, he's great at breaking an opponent down and saying, look, this shot's got to, you know, you've got to play more to this shot and do less of this and, you know, doing the X's and O's of matching people up with each other. If you look at a guy like Stefanke, I think he's one of the better technical coaches out there who will actually, I mean, look, he made Andy Roddick a technically better player in terms of his backhand improved, his slice improved, his volleys improved. Stefanke would be a more of a technical guy. You've got all of these coaches have things that they're good at, and a lot of what happens when it comes to these high-level players, their holes aren't big, obviously. The things that they don't do well on the court, there's not this laundry list. There's a few narrow things. And what we tend to see is when we find these pairings that work really well, it's because the coach and the thing that they do really well matches up well with what the player actually needs.
Right.
But a lot of the time, a lot of these top players are hiring people who don't necessarily actually have the skill set that matches with the small hole that's in their game. And we've seen a lot of that. I'm not talking about right now, and certainly I'm not talking about anybody specific at this moment, but we've seen a lot of that over the last decade of guys working with somebody who just isn't quite right for them and isn't really going to push them over the edge and make them better.
Yeah, I mean, you see that much more often than not. I think there's a sense in which, like, I've been lucky enough to work with some really talented, say, Division I level college tennis players. And so most of those guys are curious about playing on the pro tour. And we talk about how many guys really have, say, the physical talent level to play on the pro tour. There's, let's say, 2,000 or 3,000 people that have ATP points at any given time. But there's a lot more people than that that have the physical talent level to do it.
Yes.
And I think that it makes sense in the same way. If you look at the top, say, 20 guys in the world, there's a lot more than 20 guys who have the physical capability to be top 20 players. And there's more than 3 or 4 guys that have the physical capability to be number one. Now, do they have all those things put together? Do they have the mental makeup? Do they have the right team around them and the right coaches? Absolutely not. But that's part of the proof that I would submit to the point that you just made, is that most of the time the top guys aren't getting matched up with the right people. Otherwise, I think we'd see a lot more parity at the top of the game.
Yes, that's certainly true, because we do have, I mean, when you go through that list of the people that are top 20 in the world right now, there's really a lot of guys that have the weapons to get there. And when we look at them, there's just little pieces missing. If you take somebody like a Thomas Berdych, it's just little stuff that's they're not doing a good job of that is holding them back from really getting all the way. Cilic, Tiem, I mean, you just go through Tsonga, Berdych, Dimitrov. There's just so many of these guys.
All those guys, when they're playing well, like then when they're playing their best tennis, they look like, oh, man, that guy could be. I mean, we didn't even mention like Nishikori. And I mean, there's a lot, you know, and there's been a lot more, I think, over sort of history. I mean, right now, over the last few years, we've got the most dominant class of players we've ever seen. If we back up a little further, there were a lot more guys that had opportunities.
Yes. I think, I mean, there's always been a lot of people that we can go through the last 20 years of professional tennis and just pluck out name after name after name of person who we thought that guy didn't fulfill his potential. And a lot of the time, unfortunately, I think that we put so much of that on the player and just say, well, he wasn't motivated enough or he didn't work hard enough. But
right, which I think is nonsense.
Well, sometimes it is, but there's, I think there's a second element to it where how do they do that if they don't have the right person guiding them through that process? Because exactly. Not everybody is in a place to be able to basically manage their own affairs and coach themselves and still be a top 10 player in the world. That's not a common thing. And so the second part of it, which is a problem, and I think probably maybe we should start tackling in the next episode, is how are you supposed to find the right fit? How are you supposed to find the right coach when you look at the way that people typically find coaches, and especially when we're talking about high-level pro players?
Well, and to be clear, people might, I don't know what kind of assumptions are out there, but there is no like system for pro players to find a coach. It is literally based on basically who do you know? Who are you willing to go up and talk to? I mean, your agent oftentimes helps, but agents only go for big name people, period. I mean, they view their job as being at risk if they bring in somebody who's not a big name.
Yes, so they're going for a safe pick.
They're going for a safe pick. They're not trying to get someone who would take you out of your comfort zone. And then, I mean, Orange Coach, if you're not familiar with Orange Coach, you can check it out, is a really great site for sort of lower tier pros. That's like the LinkedIn of coaches. But I mean, very, very few, I've never seen anybody, oh no, that's not true. I mean, it's just very few people in the top 100 really use that. And there's not like a LinkedIn system for the top 50 guys out there to find people. I mean, I had a couple of coaches message me after the news came out, and I asked him, hey, are you going to put your name in the hat for that gig? Because, I mean, these are coaches that have worked with other top 20 players. These aren't, like, you know, people that don't have experience. And I got to tell you, man, to a T, every one of them has said, no, you know, I don't have the resume to do that. And I think they're basically intimidated. They're literally afraid to just walk up and talk to them. And so it's a very small pool that they're drawing from. I think it's a really hard thing to actually find someone that fits your unique needs without making that, it's almost like a job search, that has to be your priority for some period of time.
Absolutely. And that's a very difficult thing to do with the way that the Pro Tour is set up right now and the way that I think the coaching is set up. It's one of the problems, I think, is that so many of the people that are out there coaching on the Pro Tour right now, and even recreationally, have kind of fallen into this job where it's almost as though they don't really have another thing to do that makes sense for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you finish, maybe you're a mid-level pro, maybe you're, you know, coming back to Pepe and Mars, you get to 180 in the world, you don't, that's not retirement money. You know, you don't retire for life having made 180 in the world in tennis. No. What you maybe have done is broken even. And now you don't have a college degree. You don't have a career. You're in your mid-20s or late 20s. And you don't have any relevant work experience. You don't really have a network that doesn't relate to the tennis. And so what right. do you do? That the natural thing is to coach. And we see kind of a lower version of this with recreational players, in that a lot of the people that are coaching at country clubs and at tennis facilities are guys and girls that went to college and they were more focused on getting the tennis scholarship than what it was they were actually going to study. And they did some generic degree in a thing they weren't really passionate about, and they get out and, great, I have a degree in management and I'm not really interested in working in that field. And and the easy money is I'm just going to go and teach, you know, because it's not hard to make a decent living doing that. And unfortunately, the bigger problem here is you end up with a lot of people who don't actually know anything about teaching. They know nothing about the brain science of how we learn motor skills. They know nothing about how human beings learn. And they haven't done any work on the communication side of being a good teacher. And so they're actually very poor, not everybody, but a lot of them are actually very poorly qualified to teach anything, let alone a skill sport like tennis.
Yeah, and tennis is actually pretty sophisticated. Well, it's highly sophisticated.
It's highly sophisticated.
It's one of the reasons that we like it so much.
Right. And you know, there's how few of these people have science backgrounds? I mean, there's just so little in terms of preparation. And I'm not faulting them for this. It's just an interesting situation where the vast majority of people out there who teach tennis for a living, even all the way up through and including the professional tour, have very little to no preparation or training. The limit of their preparation training is essentially, well, I was a good player. And when you start to have in-depth conversations with a lot of good players about what made them a good player, so many of them have no real idea. They don't really understand the tactics, the strategies. They kind of intuitively played patterns that played to their strength, but it wasn't because of a deeper understanding. They have no idea about biomechanics. They don't know why their forehand was good. They just know it was good. And a lot of the things that they say, well, it was good because of X, Y, Z, are things that they got told when they were, you know, 12 years old by some coach who was working off 20-year-old theory. And so we've got this situation now where there's so many coaches out there and so few of them have any real... And don't get me wrong, there are some fantastic people out there coaching tennis. They're just not that common. There are some people out there who have very curious intellects who really go out and learn about the craft. There are people out there who come to tennis with a very strong science background and who are great players. And that gives them a framework with which to look at the sport and understand or gain a deeper understanding. There's a method to the way that they'll do things because of the background they have, the education background they have. But there are a handful of great people out there, and there's a lot of people out there who don't have those tools. And so when we look at the top tiers of the professional game and the types of people who end up coaching up there, there's some people who do a fantastic job, and there's some people who have a very, very limited skill set. And a lot of it comes down to you have the right reputation because you've worked with so-and-so, and you just name drop, you know, three people who you got into working with. And it doesn't really matter a lot of time whether or not the results that player had with you were actually an improvement over what they were getting before. It's almost like just having work with them qualifies you in some way.
Yes. I mean, in tennis, when it comes to coaching, we act like people learn through osmosis. Like you learn just from being around. And you do learn things from being around. But you don't learn everything just from being around.
No, and a lot of the learning is implicit, as in we do it in a way where we don't actually really think about it in concrete terms. It's like you just notice somebody doing something and you say, oh, that seems great, I'll do that too. And it works. Versus explicit learning where you really understand something in concrete terms where you understand all the pieces of it. And that makes it much easier for you to teach to other people. So, rant over.
rant over. I mean, there's just so much to be said there. For the record, I do want to say that there are players who maybe didn't go to school, or players who did go to school and just didn't take it seriously at all. And I have two of my really good friends in mind here, one of which who didn't go to school and one of which who did, but might as well not have gone to school. And I'm not saying that as a criticism. I mean, he would completely agree with that. But now, I mean, since their playing days are behind them, they study, and they study furiously, and they're very well disciplined, and they're really students of the game, and they've turned into world-class coaches because of the process that they go through. Much like if you're, say, an average player and you're going to turn into a world-class player, you're going to have to do some really legitimate work and work with some really legitimate processes. And so you can do that on the coaching side. You can do that on the playing side.
Yeah, there's no difference.
We're not saying that it can't be done. We're not saying that you have to be this way or have to be that way. what we're saying is when you, whether you're looking at the tour and you're trying to evaluate, like, all right, who's Pepe and Maz, or who's the new next guy that Novak's going to bring in? Is he a good fit? Is he a bad fit? You know, look at all these things and do a good job of making that judgment. Don't just jump to conclusions. And when you're trying to pick your local pro, or you're trying to figure out, should I listen to this coach over here or that coach over there? I mean, this is your responsibility to look at this stuff and figure out, well, which coach should I listen to? Mm-hmm. What's he saying? What's behind it? How did he come to that? And I would say, don't be afraid to challenge him. Don't be afraid to make your coach uncomfortable. Ask him, how did he come up with that? You know, are you just telling me that because it's what you did? Or are you telling me that because you've looked at 100 scenarios and you've analyzed a bunch of stuff and you've put hours into this and you know this is the best fit for me? And then, you know, you make your own decision. But without going too much on a rant, some common sense is really required here. And ironically, the higher we get up into the top echelon of the game, the more common sense can escape us, and it can, things become a little bit isolated.
Right. So, I think, the thing that makes it, I think, a little bit more difficult for people at the top of the game to make good decisions, besides all the other things that we've just talked about, is that at the top of the game, the margins are so small that with the way most people coach, it's, the improvements can be hard to detect. All that you see is actually just the results. And those results can change because of other factors that have nothing to do with coaching. It can change because of other people playing poorly. They can change because of things happening to you physically that don't actually have anything to do with the coaching. There's just a lot of things that go into playing good tennis.
They can change because of something that you worked on a year ago for 3 months.
Yes, that's also true.
Which happens a lot.
Yes,
so
it does.
It's hard to pin down. I mean, I think there's a science to it. It certainly can be done. It's just not immediately obvious to us all. And it you got to put some work in. I mean, it takes some time.
It does indeed.
On the tail end of this conversation, Glenn, there's one thing that I want to add, because we did spend a lot of time talking about Novak, and this is going to be my last comment, I think, to add to this for the day, is that I have said that I thought that this guy was in trouble not too long ago.
No, we did a podcast. Literally titled, How Much Trouble Is Novak Djokovic In?
And I'm on the record saying that he was in a lot of trouble. And as drastic as this move is, and I don't know what's going on in Novak's head, but I am hopeful right now. I'm hopeful that he is going to take himself out of his comfort zones, and that he's going to come back and do some new work. Not work harder, but do some new work and work smarter, perhaps. And I think that gives him a real shot to do some new things that could be potentially really, really good.
Sure. I personally am more on the worried side of things. I think that Novak just fired the wrong people out of his team, and just looking at what is required for him to play his best. And I know people aren't going to necessarily like this, but Novak is not the most technically proficient player to be number one in the world. Despite his dominance, he has things that he does very, very well, and he did a fantastic job of taking those to their extremes and executing them at an extremely high level. But he doesn't have, you know, like a Roger Federer forehand or serve. There's some of the weapons that aren't there. And for him, the physical side of things is so important. And unfortunately, I think the way that he's gone about doing things for the last year now, essentially, have put him in a physically difficult and challenging place, because it's going to take him, I think, a long time to rebuild the kind of physicality that he needs. And at this point, it's unlikely he's going to hire somebody who's going to make the technical changes that would help to speed up that process and give him more weapons that would mean that he would require less endurance and ability to run side to side like a freak for 5 hours. And I think that's less likely to happen. So I hope that I'm wrong. Again, I feel like he fired the wrong part of his team, and I really am concerned that we won't ever see Novak back at the level that he was, because I seeing Novak at the level that he was and watching him play a Roger Federer playing the type of attacking tennis that he is now, could you ask for anything
better?
Oh, it'd
be so good.
It'd be so good. It'd be amazing. But, you know, I begin to doubt that we'll ever see that. unfortunately, and it is what it is. But anyways, folks, I know that this is probably, we've said some things that might sound controversial, or at least certainly will engender an opinion in you in some way or another. So please do reach out and share your questions, share your thoughts, and even tell us if you think we're wrong. We'd love to hear it. You can reach me at glenn@tacticaltennis.com.
And I'm jacob@tacticaltennis.com.
And also, if there's something you would really love to hear us talk about, that would be a great thing to email us as well. On that note, signing off, have a great day, and we'll catch you next time.
Take it easy, guys.